you have dialed was incomplete or incorrect. Please check the number and dial again. Dial.
I am not up to the Bigsy mouth pop this morning. I had a go last week, but really, it's too big a mouth pop shoes to fill. And it's enough to try and do the show. Tony Wilson again filling in for Tony Biggs on the blower. And I've got another Tony with me, and Tony Martin. You there, Tone?
Yes, I am. And how is Bigsy? Is there an update?
He's better. He's out and ready to roll next week.
Right, okay.
So this is our last week warming the chair.
But so this is our farewell show.
It's our farewell show. 2 weeks in, the two tones. We never really even worked well to get a title, I think.
Something.
No. I was trying to do something with two-tone shoes.
Oh, yeah, really? We should be playing a lot of ska music. Is that the go?
Yeah, or gangster, sort of 20s gangster style stuff. A lot of stuff from maybe the soundtrack to The Sting.
I should have worn spats today. I know a lot of people at the R's do like to wear spats.
I'm trying to think of our spat wearer. We haven't really got one. Normally it would be, you know, broadcasters I think here like to have an identity and to stand out and to be individuals. Mm. So it wouldn't surprise me if we had a spat wearer who was doing irony spat work.
Oh, no, it's probably Headley, I think. He's one of the most dapper radio announcers in Melbourne, really.
Of course, Headley from The Party Show. Yes. Never seen by me in my 11 years at the station. Not once.
I have been seeing him every year for 20 years, and I've never seen him not wear the same clothes. Always wearing a aqua-coloured wind cheetah with a koala actually stuck 3D style onto the front. It must be some kind of lucky talisman.
Is it a Jenny Keys heavy knit jumper?
It's something like that. It's something. You've got to keep in mind, this man is, you know, we've talked about his work last week, producing and writing the film Trojan Warrior with Stan the Man Longanides.
Yeah.
Also, the creator of the legendary Ken Bruce's Gone Mad commercials.
That's him.
That was Headley. That's one of his. Oh. Yeah. See how much talent there is here at Triple R that people aren't even aware of.
I have a fight with my partner about, you know how that's, I guess that's pioneering annoying advertising, saying saying that if you annoy your viewer, they will at least notice,
and
the annoying bad ads will go better than the bad ads.
Right, okay.
So do you reckon the guy who goes, hello, at the start of his ads...
Who is that?
It's National Tiles is the company.
Right,
he calls
himself
Frank Walker, I think.
Right, okay.
Tam reckons his voice is actually like that. Whereas I say he is trying to do what Headley did so pioneeringly in the 90s.
So the man from National Tiles has
hello.
So he's had a think tank to actually come up with that?
Absolutely. He's thinking of ways to annoy me. And I am now.
Now that you're annoyed, you want some tiles.
And
how does that work?
Well, I guess what happens is if you had to buy a tile...
Yeah. I've never bought a tile, but I'll go with this.
If you have to buy a tile and you have you got a zero base starting point? So
what does
if
that
you
mean?
Can, as in, there's nowhere to go. Like if you don't know what to do.
No,
like,
nothing.
Like for example,
know.
If I need my carpet cleaned,
right?
If I can half dredge up the sound of something that cleans carpets,
yeah, right.
Then I might go to them because I don't know any others.
Right.
So I ended up going to the guy who parks his car 3K away. I always drive past the van that says Yellow Brick Road Carpet Cleaning. So he gets the job. But that's the sort of thing where you think, oh, I just have no idea where to start. And so, I think tiles are like that. You just have no idea where to start. And so if someone says hello and makes you remember their annoying tile company,
yeah,
they get over the line.
I guess that's true because, like, I don't know anything about cars, but years ago, I think we've talked about this before, there was that guy Bibbs Stillwell.
Yeah, yeah, his name.
And he had a jingle that where there just wasn't enough syllables in the scan. So the jingle went, "You can believe in Bibbs Stillwell, the man knows cars." It was like it should have been 9 syllables and he only had 3, so he just stretched them all. And that was so annoying that, yeah, I'd just find myself waking up 3 in the morning going, "The man knows cars." It should be da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but it's da-da-da. So, you know, I never did buy a luxury vehicle, but if I had, that's the man I would have gone to.
And also, his name is doing the same. Like, he says, "I will go into the market," with everyone going, "Don't they? Haven't they just misspelled that as Bob?" That's Bob Stillwell, Bob, right? And then they put the wrong vowel in. Jesus.
A New Zealand copywriter has done the sign, and it's too late to change it. I'll just be Bob Stillwell now.
And so, I mean, Bibb must be his real name, I guess. But it's that would be working on a similar principle. Everyone who looks at Bibb Stillwell goes, has a second look.
And wants to have a second look and go in and buy a luxury vehicle, although I should point out, I think he's dead, so obviously condolences to the family.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. If he isn't dead, again, double apology on that front. These really aren't the topics we're going to be tackling on the Blower today, are they?
Big topic. Everyone's always got the right to ring up with whatever they want on this show.
It's house, what's the phrase? Liberty Hall here at...
It's a big block of cheese day, as they call it on the West Wing, where I think one of the presidents used to put a big block of cheese in the lobby of the White House. And anyone was welcome to come and just hack a bit of cheese off and be a part of the democratic process. And they now, in the West Wing, they describe the day when all the tiny little action groups get to come in and have the ear of a staffer. It's called Big Block of Cheese Day.
And is that based on how it really works?
It would be. They're good enough writers that they wouldn't have made up Big Block of Cheese Day, I don't reckon.
You're a big fan of that show, and I see now that that writer's previous show before the West Wing called Sports Night
is coming on?
Is on DVD in the States. And people always tell me that was a very good show. Went out at 4 in the morning, so that's usually a good sign.
Here it went out at 4 in the morning.
Yeah, on Channel 9, I think. Yeah.
Oh, isn't that sad?
Hmm.
But he is excellent. You could say, I'm interested for you to watch The West Wing. You've got to probably commit about, or at your rate, about 6 months. It's pretty big. It's 150 episodes.
Yeah.
7 series, 23 a series. So
I know people love it, and I don't want to bag it, but I did see a couple of episodes early on, and I sort of worked out...
Too much syrup?
I worked out what the formula was. The formula is somebody sitting in an office, and then his boss will come in and give him a half bollocking. Will come in and go, "Look, mate, the president's got to make a speech. You've got to have that stuff on his desk in the morning. The president's going to look like a fool unless you have this. The ambassador's coming. He's got to know all the information. By the way, how's little Bobby doing in school?" There's always just a personal touch at the end of the of the bollocking. So I don't know, but I'm told it's really good. But is it as good as The Sopranos and Deadwood?
It's different. It's definitely network as opposed to cable. So you don't get that kind of... Like, if you can imagine in The West Wing, really, there's sort of very filthy language, abuse in quite dramatic ways, abuse without either nice personal touches at the end or kind of really witty... Like, the abuse is always very witty in The West Wing.
Right.
You know, and everything's a perfectly written line sort of thing.
But no one gets thrown to Woo's pigs at the end of it.
No, it's not violent, and it's got a sort of corniness, I guess, with the big soaring music. As a friend of mine always says, Snuffy Waldron, you've done it again. Because the scorist or the music writer in The West Wing...
Is
W.G. Snuffy Waldron. And as Mel says, Snuffy Waldron, you got me again with the big lump in the throat.
Do you find that names in credits of TV shows just get stuck in your head like the Bibb Stillwell jingle?
Yeah.
I had one of those years ago with the Australian series of telemovies, The Feds. And it was starring, I can't remember who it was, it was someone like Peter Mockery or, you know, Angie Milliken. And then it would say, and John Bache as Rainier Bass. And the idea was like, why do you need to know he's Rainier Bass? Are people going to be watching going, well, I'm glad John Bache is playing Rainier Bass, because it wouldn't have been the same.
That's an angle they do at the last credit with the character underneath. Like there was one, I think, on that Melrose Place used to have that with the blonde, the guest starring Heather Locklear as.
Well, I think it started in... I first remember it in 70s movies that had a lot of boxes on the poster. So it'd be films like Earthquake or The Towering Inferno or Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. And down the bottom, there'd be a lot of boxes with all the actors' faces in them.
Yeah.
And they'd say, you know, Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. And but then the last one would always say something like, and Fred McMurray as Wilbur. And you go, why in The Towering Inferno do we need to know that Fred McMurray is as Wilbur? That was a very odd. So I think that's where that started, adding the character's name. We're not really tackling the big issues yet, are we? Yet, we're just warming up here at On the Blower.
It is a big block of Tuesday here at On the Blower in the last incarnation of the Two Tones before Tony Biggs resumes his rightful position here next week. We'll send out an early get well to Biggsy now, which will be hopefully reinforced over the course of the 3 hours with well wishes from both ourselves and many concerned listeners who have been worried about Biggsy's health, but he is on the mend and will be back with us next week. In the meantime, you're stuck with my music. And
what have you
if you've got any
us,
complaints, make sure you ring up with content as well as the complaint. That'll be good. This is Wagons. You'll have no complaints about that. That is Walk on Fire.
Yes, that's Barry Adamson from the album Back to the Cat. I think that was his last album. Barry Adamson, ex of Magazine, for the old people listening.
And before that, Wagons, The Rise and Fall of Good Town is the album, and the track I plucked was Good Town, written by 1H Wagons. You may have seen him in conversation with our own Phoebe Squared a couple of weeks ago up on Sydney Road somewhere.
Yes, the Breakfasters.
Yes, the Breakfasters. I forgot to thank the Breakfasters. Yeah. This is how quickly I jump ship. Once I'm gone, I'm really gone. Of course, the polite thing to do on Triple R is to thank the show that went before you. Mm. And yet I allowed them to disappear off into the yonder without so much as a word. So I'd just like to say thank you to the Breakfasters, Phoebe Squared, Michael Williams, and John Origlasso filling in for Sam Pang. And we heard from Sam Pang.
Yeah, now he's... we're in Russia.
He is in Russia doing...
There's a giant photo of him in the Herald Sun today.
Really?
Yeah. He's going to be Mr. SBS within a year. He's got his own show now.
They seem to be in a halfway house at the moment because obviously Julia Zemiro is kind of the well-known face of the two that are presenting this weekend. But they're sort of throwing Sam in as if people know who he is.
Right, right.
And sometimes they're leaving him out altogether.
I've noticed that. He's just a shoulder in a photograph.
Whereas in 2 months' time, when his show is on, he'd be muscling in there front and centre with her.
I've had a bit of a sneak peek look at that. ADBC, which is his new history quiz they're describing it as, which makes it sound extremely boring, but it's going to be good.
Yeah.
Mm, I think it is. Of course, he could still cock it up. It's early days.
But no pressure, really. He's flying under the radar with Zemiro taking all the Eurovision heat. Because there will be some... and Sam knows this. We've had a good chat about what a hiding to nothing he's on, really, on this gig with people. They love this Terry Wogan.
Yeah, and really?
They do love him. I actually don't watch it each year to know what the Wogan fuss is about.
No, neither do I.
But
it's one of those things. It sounds like a funny idea to say, "Hey, let's all watch the Eurovision Song Contest," and then it's like the Logies. You go, "This will be funny,"
but the gap between each Wogan quip
that's right.
Is pretty much 4 minutes of excruciating pop.
Maybe Sam will be flown from the Eurovision over to the Cannes Film Festival while he's there. Have you seen any footage from that?
I saw in The Age this morning they were describing the Cannes Film Festival as the second biggest international event on the calendar after the Olympic Games. It was like
how
one of those.
Is that? What, most expensive or.
To me, it sounds like some Felicity from Publicity has got completely out of control on that because it's a ridiculous... They only have to set up some red ropes, some red carpet and line people up outside existing theatres.
It's just picture theatres and norgs, from what I can see.
It'd take about 20 minutes to get ready for it, wouldn't it?
People walking between the two.
Yeah.
What is on from us? Is there any Australian gear there this year?
There is. Samson and Delilah's
on board.
And it opened with the latest Pixar, Up.
Which I've heard is really good and possibly the best Pixar so far.
Well, have Pixar fluffed it yet?
Well, what was interesting was Wall Street decided to bag the film before anyone had seen it because I don't know who this was, but possibly investors in the Pixar company, I don't know, were complaining that because Up, which if you haven't seen the shorts, is about an old man who decides to turn his house into a hot air balloon. So it's like it's a kid's film. Well, not necessarily a kid's film, but the main character is like an 80-year-old man. So people are going, well, we can't market this. We can't make toys. Children aren't going to be interested. This, they keep doing this. They did it with that the Ratatouille one. There was nothing we could make. And you're going, but hang on, that was like one of the best films of the year. You know, so they're complaining that Pixar, because they're just going off and making good films, aren't coming up with enough, you know, lovable little creatures that we can turn into.
There's,
you know,
a kid on the balloon too, isn't there?
Cups and McDonald's. Yeah, exactly. There'll be something in there they can turn into a toy.
And then they, I think they head off to South America. Surely they stumble across a toucan or something, don't
well,
they?
Well, the people in the article were saying, look, the last one they gave us, the one that really gave us something we could market was Cars. And I'm going, that to me was the only dud that they've done. That was just like I was watching an ad for a video game or something.
Yeah.
But Ratatouille, that was a fantastic movie.
That was a good film.
The Incredibles.
Sensational.
Monsters, Inc. That was a beauty.
My partner wanted to call our kid Dash.
Really?
As a result of the Incredibles. No, not as a result of the Incredibles. As a result of the name Dashiell.
Oh, right. Okay. Dashiell Hammett.
Yeah.
Dashiell Hammett only wrote 5 novels, then did nothing for about 60 years. Except, I think, drinking and communism.
What were those 5 novels? Are they famous?
Red Harvest is an absolute corker, if you've never read it. The Maltese Falcon.
Oh.
The Thin Man.
Really?
The Glass Key. And I think The Dane Curse. 5 novels. That's it. And then just bugger it, pens down, drinking and communism for 30, 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah. I guess lazy novelists would be quite a good...
lazy novelists? Is that going to be our phone?
Let's not write that down.
Is that what something Bigsy would do?
Well, maybe not. Bigsy would ask for budget responses, and people are welcome to do that if they like.
Let's do lazy novelists.
Lazy novelists. I mean, the famous one, a lot of people raise Harper Lee.
No, just one book.
A lot of people say she didn't write it herself.
Really?
Well, that's... She would be.
So who do they?
Luckily, we're a long way away, and she probably doesn't stream because she might want to. she might want to reply simply by handing me a writ.
Who's implied that? Who do they imply wrote the book? Dan Brown.
No, I don't know. Does it begin with
an if it begins with an unnecessary adjective, it will be Dan Brown.
What's his book begin with?
The opening word of the Da Vinci Code is renowned, and that's when I just closed the book and said I'm not even going to read the second word of this book.
People hate that book for its writing.
Yeah, well, Stuart Lee, the comedian, his favourite line from it is, the famous man looked at the red cup. But my favourite is the opening line, renowned curator, somebody staggered through the Louvre. Why do we need to know he's renowned?
Well, surely, yeah, his behaviour should tell us that he's renowned.
Just say a man staggered through the Louvre having been shot. What do we need? Oh, we better get rid of the fact that he's a renowned curator in it, the very first sentence.
Yeah. But do you know that I still think that sort of book, do you think it's only marketing that sells that sort of book?
People love story momentum, and they love what's going to happen next. And people, if they can get a book that's got what's going to happen next factor, they'll endure any amount of appalling writing.
That's right. It's a different skill, but it should be acknowledged as a skill. I get really annoyed by the highfalutins.
Yeah, I agree.
Who undersell bad writing, good old-fashioned bad writing that makes you want to keep reading.
But what you want is can you get both in one book? Can you get good writing and what's going to happen next? I think the Secret History by Donna Tartt is a good example of that.
Some people hate that book because the thing, can you get good writing, what's going to happen next, and likable characters or a likable character.
Do people find them too hateful?
I think in that book, a lot of people find a lot of people love that book, including me.
Yes, but I love
there
it.
There is
too.
They were all quite awful.
I guess so. I mean, I'm not I don't know. I guess because I've worked in a world where people are constantly telling you to make things more likeable and make things more relatable, yeah. as if somehow that will translate into popularity, and it almost never does.
So did you ever just go into the front, into the executive desks of Austereo and slap Donna Tartt's The Secret History on their desk and say, this is a magnificent piece and everyone is hateable. Yeah. I want to be one of them.
You can't bring a book into Austereo. I must have told you the story about what the program directors do when there's a new show on.
No.
This is true at Austereo. Whenever a new show is launched, they'll book like a fan. You're looking at me like I'm going to say something defamatory.
No.
I'll try and be careful.
No, I want you to say defamatory things.
This is what Bigsy does. They'll book a really fancy hotel suite in Sydney, and all the program directors will go there and listen to the show on giant speakers at full volume. Presumably so that they can know, because presumably that's what the average listener is doing at the same time, so they can identify with them. But apparently at one of these occasions, a prostitute was hired whose only job was to lie on a bed, I assume naked, I don't know for sure, and for the entirety of the broadcast, read a book. She just had to lie there and read a book. And I was told later, it was a couple of years before it was explained to me, that it was to freak out one of the new guys. You know, wouldn't that be? That's an hilarious thing to do. Why don't they just have this woman reading a book on a bed and refer to it?
At the equivalent of sort of like a listening party.
Yeah.
And so people are having glasses of champagne and she's kind of lost in the general hubbub.
Yeah.
Reading
a book.
Of Mice and Men.
That's right.
By John Steinbeck.
So it was some kind of lame-ass practical joke. But to me, what I assumed it was that the concept of reading a book was so foreign and unfamiliar to the group program director, he was willing to pay money to see it done. That's what I assumed was going on there. So, no, you would never bring a book into a meeting in Austereo. You'd be thrown out.
Well,
you could bring in a Snow Patrol CD.
Yeah.
You'd be promoted if you did that.
Well, we've got a CD to play. We're compiling topics slowly through this first hour.
I want to get back
Lazy Novelists is one.
Lazy Novelists. I want to talk about is technology destroying our attention span? And we need to find out more about what's going on at the Cannes Film Festival, because I know you have some interesting information.
Yes. So that's we're going to talk the Tarantino film after a track, I think. I can't remember which CD I played last time. Let's see how this goes. To number off the things that went wrong in that press of play.
The two tones go and stand out. So I've just been bagging other radio announcers, or at least programming executives.
They do employ people that press the right buttons. I panicked when I heard the opening note of the song I meant to play, but it was actually the note that I was meant to hear and meant to play. Then I turned it down and went over to the other CD player. And I'm promptly playing some more Barry Adams.
Have you got a song to play?
Yeah, I have.
Oh, you do?
Here it goes again. That was the note that I panicked on last time. No, that was the note I panicked on.
He's frightened by a flattened fifth. That's
part of the Triple R Mafia, one Dave Graney. Track there. Have you heard about the Melbourne Mafia?
Yes, from the album Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. And I'd like to point out Dave has a new album, as he always does, has a new album coming out called Knock Yourself Out. And don't forget Banana Lounge Broadcasting, which is, I think, Tuesdays at midday.
12 till 2. Mm. And also, before that, you eventually heard a track from I'm Your Man, the Leonard Cohen tribute album from the motion picture soundtrack, and the track we heard was The Traitor by Martha Wainwright.
Yeah. Can we point out that I don't think in the 6 years you were on the Breakfasters, you were the person pushing the buttons, were you, Tony?
Only when Fee was sick.
Right, okay.
And people know to expect these kind of mishaps.
Yeah.
It's kind of like letting your two-year-old make morning tea. Things are going to go wrong if you allow someone with almost zero experience to do a job he's not qualified for. But the other option is to allow someone else to do it.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that if there's someone else doing it, you need to include that someone else in the show.
I do too, yes.
It's too hard to have someone in the room who you talk across.
It's weird.
And so we have chosen to do the show ourselves, and yeah. so one of us has to panel. And so at the moment, it's lesser of two evils stuff, isn't it?
Well, I haven't panelled since 1984, when I used to do Midnight to Dawn on 898 FM Rock in Stereo, which was a new concept in New Zealand, in Hamilton, New Zealand. Hello to people from the Waikato listening today. And I was telling you about this last week. I went, and of course I was using one of those old panels, which, you know, they wouldn't have. And I looked down, and this is
the exact same panel. They may even have shipped it over.
The same one. So I probably could use that thing if I had to.
Yeah. So what happens now in commercial? Do they still have a panel? Like, if to describe to the listeners what I have in front of me, I've got a keyboard.
Yeah.
There's CD1, there's CD2, there's a telephone button, there's an announcer's mic, there's four microphones, in fact, that I can turn on. Then there's a user input if I wanted to put in an iPod or something.
Right.
And then there's a computer button, and idents and so forth come up on the computer, and you load them up and press computer, and it all takes off. So really it's a bit like driving a car. You just need to coordinate the button push, yeah. and it should all be smooth.
And you're saying, is that what it's like in commercial radio?
In commercial radio, does it look anything like this?
It's pretty much exactly like that, but I do remember at Fox FM, which is a Melbourne radio station I'm sure a lot of Triple R listeners would be rightfully unfamiliar with, there's a sort of notice on the wall, used to be, that said, before you speak, make sure you run everything through the razzle-dazzle filter. And I assumed that was some kind of new piece of equipment. No, it just means showbiz it up. And George McEncrow, wonderful Melbourne broadcaster, recently sacked from, as is traditional.
She's a parent at my local primary school.
Oh, she's wonderful, and she was given the arse for using words of more than one syllable on the Mix FM breakfast show. And she was telling me that on that program, they're obsessed with something called the feel-good filter. So you bring in a story, you've got a story, I'm going to tell a story, and the program director will go, hey, before you tell that, make sure you run it through the feel-good filter. And I don't know what it just means to make it happier. You know, hey, 700 people have died in Sarajevo. Yeah, well, before you say that on air, run it through the feel-good filter.
Well, sorry, it's like you might concentrate in such a story on how beautiful a city Sarajevo is.
And how a small kitten was rescued from a high shelf during the conflict, something like that.
How successful the Winter Olympics were there in 1984.
Run it through the feel-good filter. I remember saying to George, when they told you you were getting the sack the night before your comedy festival show opened, did they run that through the feel-good filter by any chance? Dear oh dear. But you know, it's ridiculous. It's like a verbal dildo is how I see it for people who can't think and speak.
Well, the good thing, I think you do get almost the real personalities of the broadcasters on this station.
Yeah,
I mean, I suppose you do up it a little, because if you go truly how you feel sometimes, it could be it could be sort of like, oh, yeah, that was... Oh, shit. I stuffed up that panel bit before, didn't I, Tone?
That's
yeah, you got to kind of up it a bit.
So I guess we have got a sort of a feel-good filter.
Sort of, but it's just... we just don't turn our feel-good filter up to 11. We don't mind if some people still feel bad.
No, that's right. I'll tell you, someone who's feeling slightly bad is Tony Biggs, if you've tuned in. We're hoping he'll be back for On The Blower. He's not fully out of the woods at this stage.
But he's certainly a chance for next Friday.
That's right.
Get well soon, Biggsy.
And then the slickness will return on the
blower. Absolutely. And I think also the sabre edge of political nous will come in too. Because at the moment you've got a little bit of DVD talk, you've got a bit of books. It's kind of On The Blower light, really.
Well, we can certainly make it topical by returning to the world's biggest film festival, the Cannes Film Festival. Where what is going on today, Tony?
Well, it's Quentin Tarantino's day, or is it certainly in the next couple of days?
Yes.
Will be the big premiere of his next film, which I'm going to read it as it appears, Inglourious Bastards.
Yes, a deliberately wrongly spelt title. There was a film called Inglourious Basterds, I think an Italian war movie in the 70s. This is Tarantino's sort of, he's calling it like his Dirty Dozen movie. It's right. A bunch of men on a mission in World War II. And if you know anything about Quentin Tarantino, you'll know he's completely illiterate. He cannot spell. And what happened was the original, I think possibly even handwritten screenplay of his new film got onto the internet somehow, and the front page was he had written in his own handwriting, Inglorious Bastards, spelt, both words spelt wrong, Inglorious with a U in it,
yeah,
and Bastards with an E, as in Bastards, as opposed to Bastards, how it's spelt. And I don't know what's happened. I assume what's happened is he's gone, people were making fun of, oh, he can't spell. So I assume what he's gone is just gone, bugger it. That's how I'm going to spell it in the titles of the film. And so,
he's become George Lucas.
Yeah, so he's gone, we're just going to spell it wrong. And people have started asking him about this in interviews, and he refuses to talk about it. His standard answer is, oh, it's a movie thing. Well, the fact is, it's an illiteracy thing is what it is. But I guess just for his own culty reasons, he's gone, bugger it. You've made fun of me. Well, that's how it's going to be spelt, wrong or not. But I'm sure now children will grow up thinking that Inglorious is spelt with a U, and Bastards with an E.
As for the film, just reading the Age kind of chit-chat gossip site, and they came out saying they've onsold the Guardian Online Entertainment editor's comment that it may be the worst film ever made.
It looks really quite poor from the trailer, but it's one of those things where it's a nutty concept. You really would need to see the whole thing in one go to know whether it's going to work, because I don't think he's not bothering with any kind of realism in world. It's not a realistic World War II. I think there's probably going to be rap music in there. It's about a bunch of guys who a bunch of Jewish paratroopers who go around scalping Nazis. It's extremely violent, as you can probably imagine. The part of the problem with the trailer is that the leader of this the group of bastards is Brad Pitt. And he's just got a really quite dodgy accent. And you're going, surely this could have got someone better than that. But they've gone, well, we need Brad Pitt to shift a few units. And then there's Mike Myers is in it. Going, they call these gentlemen the Bastards. And it looks like it's something from Austin Powers. It looks ridiculous. So I don't know. It's going to be an unusual concoction. Could be great.
He won the Palme d'Or in 1994 for Pulp Fiction.
Mm.
Are you a fan, generally?
Well, I was a big fan of the first three that he did. I really liked that one, Jackie Brown. And I remember people used to make fun of Quentin Tarantino or satirise him by saying that his films were all blood and guts. Like, Ben Elton did that play. I thought it was
popcorn.
I thought it was rubbish. It was like, it wasn't at all what a Tarantino film was like. It was more of a send-up of Oliver Stone and
Natural Born Killers,
which was full of violence.
But he wrote that, didn't he?
He did, but
he didn't like it.
He didn't walk out, apparently, at the first screening. But if you remember his films as being extremely violent, but there's not. It's mostly talking. There's talking for an hour and a half, and then, oh, someone's head gets blown off. But now it's as though he has become what people have accused him of, because his films now are full of people having their heads chopped off with swords and things for a couple of hours.
But I'm not sure it was the quantity of violence that Ben Elton was making fun of.
Right.
I actually thought his point was reasonably well made against something like Pulp Fiction. What was the name of the... Was it The Wolf?
The
cleanup guy.
Yeah, right.
When a kid's head gets blown off in the back of a car. This was the scene that I remember really turning me off Pulp Fiction, because I thought there was lots of funny dialogue.
Right.
And I didn't mind the funny dialogue in lots of contexts. But then the tone of the post, like that is a traumatic moment for everyone, even hard-hearted killers, I reckon.
So
that if you have people going, oh, shit, look what you've done, we're going to have to clean up the car, you know, as the complete indifference to a 16-year-old kid having his head blown off, I actually thought that was what Ben Elton was trying to make fun of in that book,
right,
which is that there's this sort of laugh-it-up aspect to the violence.
Right.
Not really the quantity of the violence, because you're right, I didn't think there was, you know, it wasn't scene after scene of terrible violence in Pulp Fiction. But that, I reckon that was kind of pioneering in the sense of this is violent and it's realistic violence, and none of the characters have realistic reactions to it. They continue to wisecrack.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's what was interesting about that. I remember when that moment happened in the cinemas. It was like quite a shocking. It wasn't so much that it was funny. It was just that it was just out of nowhere. It was random. It was an accident.
See, I reckon my cinema laughed a lot at it.
It was kind of shock in my theater. It was like something you don't see in films, which is something just completely happening by accident like that.
Yeah.
It's like in, you know, Underbelly. I think one of the reasons that Underbelly works really well, because I think it's really quite poorly written myself.
Yeah.
But the storyline, because it's from real life, is quite a, you don't know what's going to happen. The true genius of the TV show Underbelly is Carl Williams, because the plot that he created was just so bizarrely unlikely and unexpected. It was full of things you weren't expecting to happen. Like, remember in Underbelly,
so it starts looking like unlike any other drama, because no one would plot something like this.
It has the weird randomness of real life. Like, there's a scene in Underbelly where there's some sort of hit happens and goes, maybe it goes wrong, or I can't remember what happens, but on the two guys who have done it are driving away from the scene of the crime, and they get into a small car accident and they get out and kill someone else who they've just driven into on the way from the hit.
Yeah.
Now, that's something you would never script. You would never go, hey, you know what we need in this scene is to have them have another on the
shooting,
way home.
Yeah.
And it was so... It's the weird unexpectedness of real life that makes that work. Not the dialogue like, the prince is dead, long live the prince. I mean, some of the dialogue is just embarrassing. What's that one, Tony Mockbell in a strip club, and he's going, cold cash and hot pussy. You just feel embarrassed watching it.
It's going to be a... It's interesting that they keep playing those first four or five episodes here in Victoria.
They can only show the first five out of 13, and even in that it's cut. And is Tony Mockbell
pixelated? It's going to be like a historic drama in the history of television where they're pixelating actors' heads so as not to incriminate people that they may or may not look a bit like in upcoming court cases. And this will be for years. Mockbell's got years to go.
And yet, pardon me for sniping, but the guy didn't look anything like Fat Tony, because for starters, he wasn't, what's the word, fat!
No.
Why not get a fat guy?
He looks like Gandolfini. If we put Gandolfini in, he looked like...
They should put Gandolfini.
I think Gandolfini might have passed.
Yeah.
I think he feels like he's done his mobster film.
There was some great... I mean, I loved... I thought Cat Stewart was sensational, Underbelly. But then, who was playing Mario Condello? Someone from Blue Heelers.
I haven't seen it.
It was like half the cast had like brilliant, and half of them, like Mario Condello, you're waiting for him to say the line, "That's a spicy meatball." He couldn't be more comedy Italian gangster if he tried.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, I'm just, you know, clearly it's a massive success. I shouldn't be bagging it.
No, and the Sydney one, they've rattled out quickly, haven't they? They haven't used the same directors who all had work. So I've been told that this is from someone telling me how important directors are in television, said if you liked the first Underbelly and you're not enjoying the second Underbelly, that is a result of Channel 9 needing more product for their screen very quickly after the success of the first, and all the directors who were the best directors in Australian television who did the first one were already booked up for the second one, and so they've got a second tier rank of director.
Is that right? I can't recall who the directors. I think Tony Tills was one of them. Grant Brown might have been another one, but there's now a 3-disc DVD of Blue Murder, which to me is the greatest Australian TV drama ever.
Yeah,
the only one that I wouldn't feel embarrassed showing to someone who, say, worked on The Sopranos.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. And the when you watch the documentary about the making of, you realize why no other shows are that good, because of the way it was made, the way they used improvisation in the writing. They would get the actors to improv a scene, then the writers would incorporate some of that. They'd shoot a 10-minute scene in one take, long takes with multiple cameras to give it a slightly documentary feel. You watch the documentary and you go, well, if more shows were made this way, maybe more shows would be this good. I don't know.
I've started rewatching Frontline this week.
Oh, yeah.
And did they do a lot of improv in that, or was that very tightly scripted?
I think it was quite tightly scripted, but they did do the same thing of having multiple cameras, like the Larry Sanders Show.
Yeah.
So you're not having to film one side of it and then turn everything around and shoot the other side, and everyone's got to do what they did on the first one or it won't match.
Yeah.
You're getting that kind of... I mean, Frontline isn't a documentary. It's not...
No.
It's not pretending to be a documentary, but it has a documentary-ness to it that you get from shooting it that way.
Yeah.
I sound like I'm on a very high horse this morning about very irrelevant issues.
Well, Bedroom Philosopher, I believe.
Another fine broadcaster here at the Rs, Justin Hazelwood, part of the team from Lime Champions, 7 till 8, Monday nights on Triple R. The Bedroom Philosopher has a fantastic new album out. You've got it over there.
I have.
Just look at that beautiful artwork on the cover.
He's brown suited it up. He's got a beautiful 70s style orange and yellow tie. In fact, he would cut a fine figure in around 1978.
He's very dapper. The album is called Brown and Orange. And I figured a lot of people listening to On the Blow are probably having trouble getting out of bed. So here's a song that might just help.
That before that message, we heard from I Heart Hiroshima, a Brisbane band who covered a famous New Zealand track.
A very famous New Zealand track, The Chills' Pink Frost. And that was a massive hit, bizarre as it may seem, back in the 1980s. Yes. And before that, The Bedroom Philosopher from his new album, Brown and Orange. A very fine album. The track was What Am I Supposed to Be Doing?
Because of your showbiz encyclopedia that goes on in your head, Tony Martin. I was going to talk about Dom DeLuise because he died last week.
Yes, he did die, and I would like to think that at the funeral there was just a whole lot of bloopers shown with him and Burt Reynolds cracking up.
Yeah, well, they've certainly got a quote from Burt Reynolds in a bit of the media, but I've actually put on hold this topic because we've just had some people from the office come in to the studio and tell us the very sad news that Bud Tingwell has passed away.
It's shocking.
Last few hours or yesterday or last night. So it's terrible news.
86 years old. And, I can't say that it's kind of unexpected, but, yeah, it is a shock. And it's weird for me because I was involved in an incident years ago with Bud Tingwell where he was reported as having died but hadn't. We did a segment with Bud on The Late Show called Charlie the Wonder Dog, and years after that, when we were doing another radio show, Charlie the Wonder Dog got bitten by a snake and actually died.
Right.
And there were two pages of obituaries in the Herald Sun.
It was beautiful. I would have been involved if I had known.
Oh, it was shocking. But we got Bud Tingwell to come in on the radio show, and I wrote a poem for him to read out, like a tribute to Charlie the Wonder Dog, a sad, mournful version of the Charlie the Wonder Dog theme, and got Bud to do his fantastic line, "He truly was a wonder dog." And that's the thing about Bud Tingwell, great unexpected line deliveries. Like, because we wrote that line and you're going, sure, anyone would do it, "He truly was a wonder dog." But Bud went with, "He truly was a wonder dog." He just went up on the a wonder, and it was like, I couldn't stop saying that for 10 years. So we wrote this beautiful poem about the late Charlie. Bud came in, read it out on air. Somehow, because our show was going out in Brisbane, someone must have told someone that story, and it got confused, and the story became that Bud Tingwell had been bitten by a snake and died. And I think that was reported in the Courier Mail.
Really?
Or at least on a radio station, it was announced that Bud had died from being bitten by a snake, which he hadn't.
And they talk about obituaries being in the can for some time before someone's died. Are you saying that the Courier Mail organised theirs, but it's all snake bite related?
They might have jumped too early.
You might spot that in tomorrow's Queensland papers, a sort of obituary that looks like it's a bit too snake bite friendly.
But now it really is true, and sadly Bud has passed away and left behind the longest resume in the history of acting. I mean, if you get onto the Internet Movie Database, and you will need so much memory on your computer just to look at his page.
Yeah.
I mean, it is incredible. He once called me up and said that he'd made a science fiction film in, like, 1947 or something. One of those really particular kind of British science fiction film, like the Quatermass movies. It's a very particularly sort of weird kind of film. And he'd had a call, this was in like about 2003, from, so he goes, "Some young kid in the States has called me and he wants to remake it and wants me to play the same role I played in 1947 and you're going, hang on, and I don't think it ever got made, but you're going, if it had, would that have been
a record
for someone for being 56 years between playing the same part in two different movies? But Bud would have probably have done it, because he seemed to do
everything,
about seven films a year.
Have you got a favourite Bud Tingwell role?
Well, I sort of have a sentimental attachment to The Castle, because technically I played his son in The Castle, although when we shot it, I don't think I was. I think I might have just been one of the extras, and then in the editing they went, let's make him Bud Tingwell's son. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but, yeah, I mean, there's something about that part that that I really like. And, you know, there's... well, I had to sit in a booth for several weeks trying to dub his voice. The first time I became aware of Bud Tingwell, because he wasn't a household name in New Zealand, was when we had to overdub Homicide. And I sat in a booth for several weeks and could never... It just didn't work with Bud. For some reason, it didn't work. So we went over to Leonard Teal and George Malaby. There was something about Bud that just said, hey, leave my voice alone. But we worked with him on The Late Show. I wasn't involved in the segments, but Charlie the Wonder Dog. And he had that great thing of knowing how to act badly well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's really hard to deliberately act badly and not have it seem just hammy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so many people can't do it. Like William Shatner seems unable to play himself. If he has to play himself in something, he sort of hams it up.
Yeah.
He can't seem to play. You're going, why can't you just act the way you really do in a Star Trek film in this sketch?
Yeah.
And Bud had that sort of... It's a very bizarre skill to have, but he was very good at acting badly.
It's very bizarre that he's gone. I mean, because he is almost the voice of obituaries in the sense that he's often the go-to person for on Brownlow night. I know you're not really a sports fan, Tone, but on Brownlow night they used to have these very awkward packages that they'd play for a retiring footballer.
Right.
Like, and there was one for Tony Liberatore once, I remember. And Tony Liberatore had almost like a second life as a footballer. He was a very skillful on-baller, and then he reinvented himself as a tagger.
Right, okay.
And the way that Bud Tingwell said that in the package was, full stop, full stop, I'll give you full stop. To show that Tony Liberatore would go on in a new incarnation. And so I don't know where it leaves us in terms of that kind of big voice that's going to be the voice behind all these kind of tribute packages that I think he's done.
I think it's going to have to be Rob Molinar. It's time for Rob Molinar to fill those shoes. Breaker Morant is the answer to your question. That'd be my favourite Bud Tingwell, I reckon, probably.
He plays the lawyer, does he?
Yeah, I'm not going to get military ranks right. That's just going to get calls.
Well, rest in peace, Bud Tingwell. We're opening up the lines at 10:45 today. You're welcome to ring in with your own Bud Tingwell memories.
Sure.
As well as we're collecting lazy writers, I think we've put down as...
lazy novelists.
Lazy novelists
we want to hear
who
about.
Aren't particularly prolific. We're going to have a chat after the next track or two about the internet and time saving, whether time saving devices actually save time.
Whether they do the exact opposite. And since you've brought up New Zealand music, let's have some more. I've got a track here from The Bats.
Which track number is it, Tone?
It's track number 5. It's one of the finest track 5s you'll ever hear. This is Block of Wood from The Bats.
That's Tim Rogers. What rhymes with cars and girls? Many years ago now, Tim Rogers and the Twin Set, the track 28.
That's a fantastic album. And a couple of weeks ago, Tim Rogers and I assume the Twin Set performed the entire album at the Northcote Social Club from start to finish. Really? I actually couldn't get in. It was so booked out in advance. That's how much people love that album.
Well, it was one of my favourites. Back in the Road to Nowhere days, back when I was doing a travel show here on Triple R.
Wow.
I like Upper Ways as well. What's the one where he says,
they're all great.
First time caller, long time listener, first time caller, just won 100 clams? Is that it?
I think so. Well,
it's one of my favourite lines in the song.
There's an excellent album about radio, the last song, I think, is it the songs they played?
Yeah, it wasn't, of course, Upper Ways. It was the songs they played as I drive away.
With the support band. There's some great tracks on that album.
Had a caller about lazy novelists.
Oh, right. Now, that's one of our topics this morning.
Kerouac, suggested by Elf, who likes Kerouac, said, lazy, though. Like, just didn't he write it down just in reams? No, just start writing at the beginning, end at the end, then square off the pages and send it to the publisher and don't really want to look at it again.
And
enough.
But he did more than one, didn't he? He did other novels.
He did, didn't he? But they were all that relatively low maintenance, top of the head, far away, get on it and far away, and that's it, I think, with Kerouac.
I think, the king of your lazy novelists is usually J.D. Salinger, but that's not fair because I think he has been bashing out novels and just putting them in the cupboard.
And also, it's hard to classify the lazy novelist who who spends a long time on particular novels.
Yeah.
As
Finnegan's Wake, for example.
How long did that take?
That was like 19 years. Mystifying, baffling. I can't follow a word of it. But.
A Suitable Boy was 10,
oh, really?
I think.
What about, I tell you what I like with the lazy novelist is like that guy Jeffrey Eugenides, who wrote The Virgin Suicides.
Yeah.
It was a very short book, very good. A few years later wrote that one, Middlesex. Did that win the Booker Prize? Won a few prizes. But that was like 2000, I think. Nothing since then. But keeps his name in the shops by editing anthologies. So you'll see Jeffrey Eugenides. You go, oh, there's a new one out. No, it's just a collection of other people's things that he's put his name on the front of. Another person like that is the bloke that wrote The Corrections, Jonathan Franzen. Like, he's never written anything.
He did a memoir later.
Did
that look easy?
And then some essays, a few essays.
You just write about your childhood. So, geez, I better get something out.
I know.
I'm going to bash out something about Boy Scouts and do 130 pages on that. We'll call it a novella.
Yeah. I know, obviously, some people will be thinking Tony Wilson, lazy novelist, but you have actually written another one.
I have written another one. I've written five kids' books, but people would go, 500 words? That's,
do people do that? Because I notice a lot of celebrities will, you know, Madonna.
Yeah, she did one.
Or someone will do a children's
Kylie
book.
Kylie did one too, didn't she?
But I think so, because what is the is this idea that, oh, that'll be easy, because there's only it's only going to be 100 words.
Well, if you're going to write a bad one, it is easy. You really, like, try and read Kylie's. It's got something about a princess with sparkly dress and sparkly shoes. And absolutely.
And a massive gay following.
But she would have moved so many units. Like, the economics of getting Kylie or Madonna to do your kids' book are very good.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's a ruthless, you know, to get a book. How do you get a book published, people might be thinking? Answer, get on to Big Brother.
Yeah.
I mean, how was that Damien Leith
from
novel?
Australian Idol.
Australian
Have
Idol.
Have you read the novel?
I haven't read the
See,
novel.
I feel, what if it's good is one of my... I know no one's ever told me it is, but no. It may be okay.
But the point is not whether it's good or bad. The point is, would it have come out?
Probably not.
If it, I mean, there was... I think I remember at the time reading, oh, it had been in the slush pile for 4 years, the slush pile being what they call just all the books that get sent in. But it's so good. Although we waited 4 years, we would have published it because it was that good. And then you just see stacks and stacks of it at Basement Books, you know, unsold because...
Because the Australian Idol phenomenon is a six-month enterprise each time.
And I don't think it transfers to literary fiction. I don't think people who watch Australian Idol are down looking through the John Updikes at readings.
Glenn David Gold's taken a long time on number two.
He's got one. It's come out.
Is it out or is it coming out?
It's out in America. It's called Sunnyside. And it's about Charlie Chaplin.
Do you know there's a book, Sunnyside, here written by... I'm friends with the person who wrote Joanna Murray Smith.
Oh, yep. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
She wrote Sunnyside. And that was a book about sort of infidelity down in the southern suburbs of Melbourne.
But you didn't mean, for people listening, Glenn David Gold, author of...
Carter Beats the Devil.
Very good.
Great book.
And thankfully, not going to be ruined by Tom Cruise anymore, thanks to all the other magician movies failing.
Yeah.
Because Carter Beats the Devil, and I might be remembering this wrong...
It's about the disappearance of a president.
A real...
Harding. President Harding.
Who was a real American president in the 1920s.
Did he really disappear? I never followed
up. No, he died.
Yeah.
But and there was some... I don't know whether this I'm getting this wrong, but the way I remember it is he was quite corrupt.
Right.
I think, and quite on the shonk.
Yeah, 20s was the years of spats and two-tone shoes.
And Charles Carter was kind of the Rolling Stones to Harry Houdini's Beatles in the 1920s. He was the other big magician, escapologist.
Yeah.
And I think the story goes that President Harding went along to see one of Charles Carter's shows and got called up on stage to be the victim in a trick where he appeared to be eaten by a tiger. Gasp, he's been torn to pieces by a tiger. No, he hasn't. There he is again, fully intact. But then, the next morning, Harding was found mysteriously dead.
Ooh.
So there was always an implication that somehow Charles Carter was involved. So Glenn David Gold has taken that crumb and expanded it into a giant plot. And as though Well, I don't want to spoil it.
And that's so good a crumb that I fear for his second novel.
But Tom Cruise bought the rights to Carter Beats, so they'll be going, oh no, I don't want to see Tom Cruise ruin that. But then they brought out The Prestige.
Yeah.
That one with Edward Norton, The Illusionist, and then the one with Guy Pearce as Houdini.
Mm.
All flops. So suddenly...
He's let it go, and, so, and we might wait another 5 or 10 years for Carter till he reignites the magician craze.
And isn't Glenn David Gold married to
Alice Sebold,
who wrote
Lovely Bones?
Lovely Bones,
which is coming out as a film directed by Peter Jackson.
Another New Zealand connection. There you go.
Got there.
What's it going to be like, though?
You know how I said last week, my white suited. Read of the moment, Tom Wolfe, hooking up. Not a lazy novelist, but he does
world's best novelist who dresses as a riverboat gambler.
Well, he writes this is a book of essays.
Hooking up.
Might be interesting. You might even have an author who you think can do fiction but can't do non-fiction.
Really? I'm trying to think. There's lots the other way around.
Lots that can do non-fiction and can't do fiction.
Yeah.
Basically, I just thought he captured the idea of a long write, though. I can tell you taking 11 years to write one book is a killer financially, a blow to the base of the skull mentally and physically, hell for your family, a slovenly imposition upon all concerned. In short, an inexcusable performance verging on shameful. Nevertheless, that is how long it took me to write one book, a novel called A Man in Full. 11 years. My children grew up thinking that was all I did, write and never finish a book called A Man in Full. I really like that line.
Do you feel that kind of pressure at home? Because I know you obviously left the Breakfasters primarily to sit down and write your novel.
Yes. Well, I've been going for, I guess, 15 months or something.
And do the kids... Does the kids, sorry, and your wife, do they... Is there a bit of... How many chapters?
Yeah.
I've got to buy milk.
There's a bit of that. The kid, I guess, is still two, so she's busy throwing tantrums on her back because mum isn't drying her and I am, stuff like that. So she's not really up to the sophistication of saying that making news should be going at a better clip.
Did you say it's called Making News, Tony? That's an exclusive to On the Blower with Tony Biggs, absent today, but possibly back next week.
Is
that what it's going to be called?
Well, a working title. Mm. Some people think it's a little flat.
Mm.
Hasn't got the bells and whistles of A Nest of Occasionals, which is...
Which is deliberately confusing, I'm finding now. I have to explain that so many times.
If you think of fonts, A Nest of Occasionals can go into the... can go into the with big twirly ends to it. Whereas Making News will be very blockish, you'd think.
Very blockish. There was a book called Making History by Stephen Fry.
It is. That's a good... It's of the alternative history books. It's one of the best. It's an imagining of Hitler not being born.
Right.
As a result of, I think they poisoned the water supply to make everyone on one side of the street infertile. So a time traveller goes back, causes Hitler's parents to be infertile.
Yeah.
Hitler isn't born, and so it imagines how things may have emerged in the 20th century without Hitler.
So you can recommend that book?
Can recommend it, except I can recommend it as a pretty good read.
Mm. He did one before that called The Hippopotamus, which has the greatest chapter one. There's a phone in. Books that don't live up to their own chapter one. It has like such a good chapter one, you go, this is going to be one of the greatest books ever, and then it kind of goes slightly off the boil. That's only in my opinion.
I read Moab is My Washpot. That was his
right.
That was his memoir.
And there was never a volume two, was there?
No.
He did a novel called, this was the name of it, The Stars Tennis Balls, which was such a confusing title that when it came out in America, it was called Revenge. How bland is that? Revenge. Not even revenge of something.
Certainly not lazy, Stephen Fry.
No, and certainly not talentless. I hope I didn't imply that The Hippopotamus is a bad book. I'm just saying... it's not as good as the first chapter.
So what's the premise in chapter one of The Hippopotamus?
Chapter one begins with a theatre critic who's disgraced himself in every aspect of his life. And it feels like it's going to be a great sort of Lucky Jim, drunken, fool novelist Book, and it's just, but it's sort of, it then gets veers off into this bizarre near science fiction kind of plot, but he creates this fantastic central character in the first chapter.
Lucky Jim, that's one to put on your list if
that's
you haven't
funny,
read it.
It's a funny book.
Yeah, from he doesn't deliver ever again. There's an element of what's his name? Can you just help me with
Kingsley
his,
Amis?
Kingsley Amis, where everyone says that he's like a poster boy for misogynist writing.
Yeah,
that he's that he doesn't like women, and there's an element of Lucky Jim where you can see that can see how that allegation is going to be raised, but it works in the context of a 1950s set university and the particular character that's profiled, and I didn't find that very annoying.
And it's a very funny...
Very funny.
Just a very funny book, and much ripped off. So many stand-up comedians have ripped off the idea... The humour about your breath when you wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
Someone used to talk about... it's as though someone's taken a dump in your mouth while you're asleep. Well, that all comes from Lucky Jim. And, yeah, never wrote, as I understand it, I've never read any of the others, but never wrote another novel as good, but wrote three excellent books about drinking, which have now been out of print for several years and have now been recollected in a beautiful hardcover called Everyday Drinking, which I recommend as a great present to buy someone.
Yeah.
Everyday Drinking and by Kingsley Amis.
Martin Amis, his son, he's the darling of the literary scene. I find him hard, as my daughter would say. Every time I try to read, I've got Money.
Money is the only one I really got through.
And do you like it?
I did like it. It's a very nasty book, though. Extremely nasty, but quite single-minded, and it works.
Yeah.
Some of the others I'm not that keen on. Listen to me just bagging all these great writers.
Yeah.
Sorry about this.
Doesn't matter. They're not here.
Lazy novelists is what we're looking
lazy
for.
Lazy novelists. We're also looking for deliberate misspellings for the sake of art. That's happening with Quentin Tarantino at the moment.
Yep.
He has, we mentioned earlier on, he has a film on at Cannes that is called...
It's called...
Inglourious Bastards, with deliberate misspellings in both of those words.
Yeah.
So if you've got... One where you there was actually a children's book called Wolves in the City by Margaret Wilde. She wrote a great children's book called Fox.
Right.
Whereas I would say that this children's book verges onto the pretentious, because Wolves in the City is spelt WOOLVS in the CITEE city.
And is there a story reason
for
that?
Yeah, it's kind of a dark, otherworldly thing, and the way she's tried to create the other world is that it's not even really our language. You can read it through phonetics, but you won't get... whereas I would have thought one of the key things with kids' books is that if kids should ever want to read it,
right,
the example we're setting is the correct spelling of the words. But she won awards and I haven't, so I'm not going to say what's right and wrong.
I love an accidental misspelling on a DVD cover. That's one of my pet topics.
Yeah.
The initial version of Escape from New York in Australia had Kurt Russell, the main star's name, spelt wrong.
What's C-U-R-T?
Russell with only one L. Dr. Detroit, that classic film from the 1980s with the music by Devo with Dan Aykroyd, has come out on DVD a couple of weeks ago. Dan Aykroyd's name spelt wrong on the front.
How?
Well, his name is spelt A-Y-K.
Yeah.
So it's a name with two Y's in it, A-Y-K. They've spelled it A-C-K, as in Anthony Aykroyd. A few years ago, the excellent Australian documentary The Wonderful World of Dogs came out on DVD. But when you look at the spine, it says The Wonderful of Dogs. That's a good one. Knocked Up, if you want to have a look at the back of Knocked Up, there's three spelling mistakes on the back of that DVD, including the name of the star, Seth Rogen. His name is spelled wrong.
How'd they do that?
With an A. You'd think it would be with an A, wouldn't you? Rogan.
Yeah.
Wrong.
Like Rogan Josh.
It's Rogan with an E. Another one that I spotted recently, Knocked Up again, has been released in a double DVD pack with another film. Not the one with the Virgin, 40-year-old Virgin. That's actually a good double pack to buy.
Yeah.
There's another one where it's come out like for Mother's Day and sort of a pink cover with something. And they've spelt Knocked Up with two Ks. Knocked Up. That one. And what was the other one I spotted? I found a beauty recently. I should have written this down before we started speaking. But that's a good one. Names. Oh, actually, Playing Beatty Bow.
Oh, yeah.
Australian film.
Written by Ruth Park was the book.
Might have been. If it is, that's a link to me because she grew up in the town I was born in, Te Kawiti, in New Zealand.
Okay.
It's on the spine, it's spelt with one T, BT, on the cover, spelt with two. But both of them in the form of a logo. So somebody's actually made the same logo twice with different spelling and put one on the... I'm not sure which one's right.
We'll put them both on there.
But that's great. A deliberately misspelt or accidentally misspelt DVD cover. Hardly, I would have thought, the kind of world-beating topic that would get the phones running hot when Tony Biggs is in the chair. So what are we... We're almost at phone time, aren't we? Because I don't want to go too early.
We're going at phones at 10:45.
Do we want to have a track? Come back with some meaty issues for people to.
Well, we've got a giveaway.
We've got a giveaway. We have indeed. We mentioned the Northcote Social Club. Tim Rogers down there. Well, tonight, Gun Street Girls are launching their debut single, "How I Roll," with guests, the Pictures, and the Supporters. Gun Street Girls, of course, are Dave Larkin, flanked by double agents Dave Butterworth on bass and Callum Barter on drums. Tickets $15 and booking fee from the Northcote Social Club box office. They're always very helpful, I find, if you call them up. Or on the door, Gun Street Girls, launch Northcote Social Club tonight. But I can't afford that $15, you're thinking.
Yeah, so how many are we giving?
One double pass.
Excellent. Well, I'll take that call right now off air. And I would play the track, but due to the limitations of my CD collection, we're playing this track.